Welcome to Long Live Bad Art, the podcast for art lovers who don't see art as much as they want to. My name is Sydney, and thank you for taking this little tour through an art gallery with a casual art lover. Today, I'll be talking about Vanitas Still Life by Jacques Degain II. I hope you enjoy. Jacques Degain II is also known by the first name Jacob, but I'll continue to call him Jacques because that's what the placard at the museum called him. Jacques II was born in Antwerp in around 1565. His father, Jacques Degain I, trained him. Jacques I was a glass painter, engraver, miniaturist, and draftsman. The draftsman part means that he produced very technical drawings, almost like an architect does. I couldn't find what Jacques I drafted specifically because most of the sources I found are on Jacques II. In 1585, after his father died, Jacques II went to Haarlem in the Netherlands to study under Hendrik Goltzius, who was a painter and engraver for 5 years. In the mid-1590s, Jacques II moved to Leiden. His work was so extraordinary that his very first commission was for then Prince of Orange Maurice of Nassau, of the siege of Geertruidenburg. The siege was actually more of a power move than an actual war, and the engraving was more or less propaganda to show Maurice as a capable general. Unlike many of the artists we've covered this season, Jacques II never took a trip to Italy and didn't seem very interested in that style besides an interest in Pisanello, who was an Italian Renaissance painter. Jacques II was apparently a forerunner of Dutch naturalism, which is an interest in the natural and scientific world. A few engravings of this aspect of his interest survive, including one that details constellations published in 1600. He also did an engraving of Tycho Brahe, an astronomer, chemist, and astrologer. He also portrayed Carolus Clusius, who was a botanist, and the mathematician Ludolf von Seelen. Carol von Mander, who Jacques II later drew on his deathbed, detailed his work as a naturalist that also worked from imagination. Von Mander said that he, quote, did much of from nature and also from his own imagination in order to discover all available sources of art, unquote. Around 1600, Jacques II left engraving behind to focus on painting and etching. He moved to The Hague in 1605 and was often hired by Dutch royalty. He designed a garden for his old patron Prince Maurice that included the first grottos implemented in the Netherlands. After Prince Maurice died, Jacques worked for the prince's brother, Prince Frederick Henry, who you might recognize from episode 11 on Paulus Bohr. He also registered with a painter's guild while in The Hague called, you guessed it, the Painter's Guild of St. Luke. Jacques II married Eva Stalpert van der Wiel in 1595. They had a son bearing Jacques' name in 1596, and Jacques III became an engraver in his own right. Jacques III was also a subject of a Rembrandt painting later. Jacques II was one of the first Dutch artists to paint the nude female figure, floral still lifes, and Vanitas. I'm not sure if he was actually one of the earliest or just created the early surviving works. And a Vanitas, one of which is the subject of today's episode, is a term that means an artwork that depicts, using symbolism, the fleetingness of life. It also, apparently, is supposed to symbolize the futility of pleasure and certainty of death. The name comes from Latin and means vanity. A little dark, but the painting is still beautiful. Jacques II is said to have created over 1,500 drawings. He also did 117 engravings purely for a military manual whose translated name is The Exercise of Arms, and it helps soldiers learn techniques they use to win their independence from Spain. He painted only rarely, and I couldn't find an estimated number for his original works. Jacques II created art in the transition between Mannerism and Naturalism in Dutch art. Mannerism is a high Renaissance art style, focused heavily on ideal beauty, proportion, and balance. Naturalism is just what it sounds like, a shift of focus to how things look in reality. It's also called realism. His engravings especially showed the shift. One source I found called them, quote, outstanding documents, unquote, to show the change because of, quote, their spontaneity and informality, unquote. Jacques II died on March 29, 1629 in The Hague. About 20 oil paintings, but hundreds of his drawings survive. On to the painting. The painting's focal point is a human skull in the center, directly facing the viewer of the painting. The top and bottom two frontal teeth are missing. The eye sockets of the skull are shadowed in a dark color, maybe a brown, and not black. The skull is painted in neutral tones, shades of beige. The jaw is squared, and you can see the slight shadows that the roots of the teeth still in the skull cast. There's a small nick or discoloration on the right side of the space, just below the nose and teeth. The protrusions where the cheek is are visible on the left side, but not the right. The right is in complete shadow. The light source is hard to pin down, but I think it's coming from the viewer's left and into the painting. The skull is resting in an alcove made of brown wood, the right side of which is a more rosy wood and the left side more dull. The top of the alcove comes to an arch with a soft point. Also in the alcove, above the skull, is a large sphere that looks like a soap bubble. In the upper left of the bubble, a couple of inches from the top, is a reflection. The reflection shows a slightly distorted reflection of a space that could be a window with two vertical bars in it. Something shadowed is resting on the edge. It could be the top view of the skull. The bubble has another reflection on the bottom right, this one showing what looks like a simple wooden chandelier, almost a wheel, on the ceiling. Behind the bubble, splitting it in half horizontally, is a squared ledge in the alcove. The ledge is decorative. It's not nearly wide enough for anything to rest on. The ledge has two sections with a slim lower part that's maybe a quarter of the size of the upper part. The lower part is more set into the alcove. The top arch of the alcove is sectioned into seven brick-like rectangles with the part framing the alcove slightly shorter than the top part. On either side of the arch are two figures carved into the wood. They're both pointing in the general direction of the skull. Both figures are two bricks high and leaning to further frame the alcove. The left carving has a garment billowing behind it that's tight against the front. It's pointing past the skull with its right hand, and its left is higher up and also pointing, this one more subtly and towards the top of the bubble. The figure's left foot is flat on the ledge, and its right is on the wall. There's a lighter section of wood in the circle behind the figure's head, almost like a saint's halo. It's facing the center of the alcove and down. The second carving has its right arm resting on the arch and that hand in a fist that it's resting its cheek on. This figure is also facing towards the alcove and down. It has a long beard. Its garment is more static, not billowing. On the top brick in the arch is a carving of Latin words. H-V-M-A-N-A on one line, and V-A-N-A on the second. So it could read Humana Vana, which could mean human vanity, but I'm not entirely sure. In front of the alcove, on either side, are two silver vases that look almost like chalices with a short stem, a rounded band just below the cup, and a body that looks like an egg standing on its narrow edge. The right one has what looks like a small curl of smoke coming from the shadowed opening. That one has a point of reflected light on its left side, maybe an inch from the top. There's no reflection. The left vase has a tall tulip in it, the flower ending just above the skull. The flower is odd. It's a fiery orange with almost gold highlights. It's almost like someone gently brushed it with gold powder on the edges and tips of the petal. Its stem is dark green and has three long, wavy, gently cupped leaves on it, two on the right, and one on the left. Beneath the tulip and in front of it, it's a much smaller white flower with four petals and a yellow center. On either side of the white flower are either very dark flowers or leaves that almost blend into the wood. Beneath the vase, it's a single heart-shaped petal from the smaller flower, its point towards the left of the painting. The petal is on the left side of the stem. This vase has the same reflected light as the other one, only a little more to the right of the place where the reflection is on the first. Beneath the vases, on the front of the shelf they're resting on, are two large tarnished gold or light bronze coins or seals, maybe Greek or Roman in origin. They both have lettering around the outside in some language I can't read. The left coin, or seal, features two crowned figures facing each other, one male and one female. The female figure is on the left. The female figure is also wearing a veil, obscuring her hair. Her crown has gentle points connected to its neighbors halfway up. The male figure is slightly shorter than the female, but he has a more pointed crown with more spread apart points. The right sealer coin has what looks like a squared string instrument like a lyre and a banner underneath with more writing. It could be the other side of the coin if they are indeed coins. The lyre decoration can also be a shield with five slim vertical bands. The top is flat, as are the sides, and the bottom is pointed. Also on the shelf with the vases are things that are more easily identifiable as coins. The coins are stacked at some parts and laid out at others. The four silver coins on the left of the shelf are an inch wide and stacked, two in each stack. They're almost exactly lined up, but not quite. Both stacks' top coin is slightly to the right, exposing the left edge of the coin underneath. The right stack has a silver coin of a similar size leaned up against the right side, and a copper coin of the same size leaning on that one. Further back on the shelf are two large copper coins, an inch and a half or 2 inches wide. They're stacked as well, this time with the top coin slightly skewed to the left side. There are four copper coins piled closer to the edge of the shelf in front of them, these ones are the size of an American penny. The two on the bottom are touching sides. The left top coin has slid almost completely off to the left, and the top right coin is resting on the bottom coins, covering half of both. The final pile of coins is comprised mainly of the large silver coins. There are seven of those. The three top silver coins are laid out, almost as if they had been stacked at one point, but had slid to the left. The leftmost coin is on top. Under those three are four more large silver coins, these in stacks two apiece like the first ones. The left stack is not quite as neat as the right one. It has been skewed to the left. The right stack is almost perfectly stacked, so much so that I had to really look to make sure there was two instead of one thicker one. The final four coins are copper, two large and two small. The top left copper coin is large and resting half on the near perfect silver stack. It's also resting on top of another large copper coin, but the top one is slightly to the left. The final two coins are smaller, but larger than the penny-sized ones. One is resting on top of the large coin, and one is on the bottom of the pile. Both are jutting out to the right side, the bottom one more so than the top. Now for my thoughts. I didn't know anything before I actually sat in front of the painting and started to write down its description. I don't know 100% of the story behind any painting, as I'm sure it's clear by now. I rarely know which artist painted which work, but you don't have to be a scholar to get into art. You can get into art for the simple fact that you think it's beautiful. I don't even know why I was drawn to this painting. I mean, it has a skull, so it's awesome, but I've described another piece with a skull this season, episode 7's Youth with a Skull. Maybe it was the bubble, but I'm not entirely sure. And that's fine. You don't have to know why you like everything you do. You can just like it. You don't have to write a dissertation defending it. But I like the fact that I don't entirely know why I like this. Sure, it's as incredibly lifelike as the rest of the paintings I have covered and will cover this season, but I suspect that's not all. If I try to dissect it entirely, I'm afraid I'll overthink it. You can like, or even love, something and not know why. Enjoyment often finds you when you least expect it, and you should just welcome it when you notice it standing at the threshold. Invite enjoyment in. What I can do is pinpoint a few aspects of the painting I really enjoy, and I'll share those with you. I love the tulip especially. It looks like its edges have been brushed with gold, as I mentioned. It's a beautiful detail and an otherwise rather depressing piece. The coins on the ledge, paired with the skull, remind me of the old tradition of leaving coins with the body to pay the ferryman to bring you via boat to the afterlife. The carved figures at the top are really interesting too. They frame the alcove without intruding, and they're both looking at the scene. The carvings are almost reacting to the art, rather than being purely decorative. The museum's website, when I looked at it later to get a full picture to check my work, said that their names were, quote, Democritus and Heraclitus, the laughing and weeping philosophers of ancient Greece, unquote. So that brought to mind the symbol most people associate with dramatic theater, the masks with the laughing and crying faces. The website also informed me that what I took to be a round wooden chandelier is actually a wheel of torture. I guess I look on the bright side a lot. Speaking of the reflections in the surface of the bubble, I like them. They're distorted incredibly realistically. And the artistic choice to have a bubble present at all is odd enough. Who puts a bubble in the same art piece as a skull? But it's almost a fun choice. You all know how much I like fun choices in art. I also like the shine of the metal, how the vases are almost identical but not quite. I also like the brightness of the coins on the shelf compared to the tarnished look of the coins or seals on the front of it. It brings a mix of new and old, fresh and antique. And the way the Roman letters are barely seen unless you look really closely is interesting. It's almost a subtle nod to whoever has a presence of mind to look. It also gives the painting a classic feeling, like it's rooted firmly in history. You may see different things to like in the painting, or you may not enjoy it at all. Art may not always be fun to make, view, or both. The quote about how art should disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed by Dr. Cesar Cruz showcases that, but there's always a feeling behind it. You may not feel the same emotion the artist felt when they made it, but that's not the point. You always bring your own life experiences when you look at any piece of art, just like you do with everything else. Here's my challenge for you this time. Try to list at least 3 things you like and don't know why. It could be a TV show that no one else you seems to have heard of, or a piece of clothing that you enjoy wearing even if it doesn't match your outfit, or a tchotchke you got on a whim. Just 3 things. Don't think too hard about it. And once you've found those 3 things, except that you'll probably never understand why you like them. Say, out loud if necessary, I am allowed to like things for no reason. I don't have to defend myself to anyone, and I will not apologize for it. Also, make me a promise, never apologize for love. Because when you start downplaying what you like, you'll start to diminish who you are. Be you, loudly. Anyone who doesn't like that doesn't deserve you. And everyone should surround themselves with people who make them feel like they can be themselves. Because when you're really yourself, you shine. Being happy isn't futile, unlike what Vanitas used to promote. Ignore the depressing fact that death is inevitable, and remember that any joy you can get when you're alive is a gift. If you like this episode of Long Live Bat Art, please consider telling a friend and reviewing to help the podcast grow. A link to the transcript of this episode is available in the show notes below. And you can follow me on Twitter at @LongLiveBatArt and Tumblr at tumblr.com/LongLiveBatArt. That's long live, B-A-T, art. Thank you for listening to this episode, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.